Hello, this is Kevin Barrett of Truth Jihad Radio. It's Ramadan, so Ramadan Mubarak to all of my listeners. You know, Ramadan began this year in a very nice way. We had an outpouring of love and affection for Muhammad Ali, Allah Yirhamhu, who passed away last week, and we've had a week of celebration of the life and courage of Muhammad Ali, the man who stood up and said that he wasn't going to go kill the Viet Cong because they never called him nigger. He's also the man who said, quote, "In my name and the name of all Muslims in America, I declare support for the Palestinian struggle to liberate their homeland and oust these Zionist invaders." That was Muhammad Ali speaking in occupied Palestine. And we just had a week of everybody loving Muhammad Ali. We also had a week of the leaders of many countries, including the United States, sending the message that they very well may be pushing through a UN resolution this fall that would force the Israelis to pull out of occupied Palestine, essentially. This would be a resolution that would recognize Palestine as a nation within the borders that before the Israelis stole the West Bank and so on in 1967. So, wouldn't you know it, that after this very amazing first week of Ramadan, we suddenly would see another huge apparent false flag event in Florida. That's right, the Orlando shooting has all the telltale signs of a false flag. And for details, please do go to my article, Orlando Nightclub Shooting, Yet Another False Flag. You can find that at Veterans Today. Just put that into your favorite search engine, Orlando Nightclub Shooting, Yet Another False Flag. So I've been on this job for a while now, keeping an eye on the false flags and being the first to put out an article about it when it happens. I did it with the Paris false flags last year, the San Bernardino false flag. I did some good work on the Brussels false flag as well, and now this one in Orlando. This is hard work, folks. If you want to help support the Truth Jihad, please do go to truthjihad.com and subscribe. For only $3.95 a month, you'll get early access to the shows, free downloads, you'll get to read my private Truth blog for subscribers only, and much more. Well, a little bit more, anyway. So do go to truthjihad.com and see what you can do to help out. So anyway, we have a great interview coming up today. It was recorded just a little bit before this big false flag in Orlando with Zaid Hamid, one of Pakistan's leading defense and strategic analysts, who spent 4 months in a Saudi prison for political prisoners earlier this year. And he was lucky to get out with his head connected to his body. Zaid Hamid is one of my all-time favorite people. He is a real brother. He's what the tribe would call a real mensch. He's one of my favorite guys. And so we have a great interview with him coming up in just a moment. So here we go with today's episode of Truth Jihad Radio. Welcome to Truth Jihad Radio. I'm Kevin Barrett, waging the all-out struggle for truth during the long fasting days of Ramadan and for the rest of the year as well. I do like to check in with people in different corners of the world to find out what's going on there. We have a couple of roving correspondents, people like Andre Volchek, who move around. And I also like to check in with well-informed people in important places. And one of those very well-informed and important people in a very important place is Zaid Hamid in Pakistan. Zaid Hamid is a courageous, truth-speaking Muslim who has a long history of activism for truth and justice. And in Islam, he actually fought in the struggle to expel the Soviet occupiers from Afghanistan, and he's been fighting for Pakistani patriotic objectives and for justice ever since. I met Zaid Hamid in Iran a few years ago, and since then, he ended up getting his head chopped off by the crazy Saudis. He was arrested for apparently said something they didn't like, and he was badly treated in a Saudi prison. He was in there for quite a while. We tried to raise a stink about it, and alhamdulillah, thank God, he got out okay, and he's back in Pakistan. He's one of the most qualified analysts of international affairs, military affairs, anywhere. So it's an honor and a privilege to welcome Zaid Hamid to Truth Jihad Radio. Welcome, Zaid. Good to have you.
Kevin, stay blessed, and it's my pleasure and honor to be with you. And my salam to all your listeners. It's wonderful to have you all.
Yes, well, it's great to have you back. We were worried about you for a while there. That's an understatement. Getting imprisoned by the Saudis for a free speech offense can often cost one's life. Those people, they claim to be fighting for freedom and democracy in Yemen and Syria, and yet if you say a word against this insanely corrupt ruling clique, I don't know if you said anything as strong as I've sometimes said. You just don't know what might happen. So I don't know if we should we talk about that? You know, what happened since I last saw you in Iran that got you locked up in Saudi Arabia?
And now I think we should talk about that, because it was one of the most fascinating, or I would say, nightmarish experience of my life. And the fact is that, you know, I speak on national security issues. I come regularly on Pakistani media, mainstream media channels, and I give my opinion on regional and national security issues. So when the Saudis started their war in Yemen, they unanimously declared that Pakistan is going to join the coalition in Yemen and on the side of the Saudis. And I was the first person who came on the media and rejected this proposal. And I said, Pakistan army is not going to go out of Pakistan for a sectarian war in Yemen. Pakistan is going to be acting as an arbitrator and a peacemaker between Iran and Saudi Arabia. And the war in Yemen is probably going to ignite sectarian and regional tensions on sectarian lines. So this policy of mine, this statement of mine, actually became the national mainstream. Pakistan army accepted it, Pakistani political parties and parliament accepted it, media accepted it, and actually Pakistani parliament passed a resolution refusing the Saudi demand that Pakistan army should go to Yemen. So basically what I did was that I created a national movement stopping Pakistan army from going to Yemen. And you can imagine that is something that destroyed the entire Saudi game plan in Yemen. They were counting on Pakistan army.
Well, that's right. Pakistan has one of the most formidable armies in Muslim Asia, Middle East.
Pakistan army is the strongest army in the Muslim world. We are a nuclear-armed country. We are battle-hardened for the last 15 years. We are fighting massive insurgencies, urban wars, fourth-generation, asymmetric, hybrid wars. And the most battle-hardened, battle-tested army is Pakistan. So Saudis were counting on that. So when I created a national movement refusing the Saudi demand, obviously Saudis were furious. For them, this was my declaration against Saudi Arabia, which in fact it was not there. I spoke in front in the benefit of the Muslim unity in the Muslim world, in the interest of peace and humanity, that Pakistan should not join a coalition which would be slaughtering women and children in Yemen in a civil war, which would ultimately fall out into a regional sectarian conflict.
That's completely reasonable.
That's totally. In fact, that's the demand, actually. That's the voice and the argument that the Pakistani parliament took also later on. So when I went to Umrah for my pilgrimage last year in this exactly same time in Ramadan, and just a few days before Ramadan, I landed in Medina last year. And Saudis were waiting for me. And they arrested me from Masjid al-Nabwi, and right from the most sacred of masjids. And I was arrested next to the grave of the Prophet, you know. And my wife was also arrested. We were both kept in a prison for a night. In the morning, they let her go. And then my ordeal started. I spent the next four months in the most notorious black holes of judicial system in the world, called the Saudi intelligence prisons, you know.
Wow.
And my allegations on me were that I am an Iranian spy, and I have instigated this movement on behalf of Iran, and subversion against the kingdom, and subversion against the king. Basically, the same allegations which get the heads chopped off. I mean, the Sheikh Nimr was executed. He was number 47th in a list of 47 people who were executed. Probably my number was 48, you know. Same allegation, same charges.
Wow. That's so we were correct to be worried about you.
Well, worried is a small word, I would say. You should have actually said goodbye to me. I mean, everybody in Pakistan thought it's goodbye. He's not going to come out. The Saudis themselves told me inside that they're either going to chop my head or going to keep me 10 years in prison, and there is absolutely no possibility that I can come out alive or sooner from that prison, from those black holes. And I was not alone there. I mean, there are at least 15,000 to 30,000 political prisoners in Saudi prisons. Yeah. And I'm probably the only person who has actually come out to tell about this. Because the prison complexes are out in the desert. And nobody goes there except the inmates or the security guards. And they're spread into kilometers by kilometers.
Can you restate that number? 30,000 to how many political prisoners in Saudi Arabia?
You see, nobody exactly knows how many political prisoners are there, but from the 4 months that I spent in various prisons, I spent time in Medina, I spent time in Jeddah, I spent time in Qasim, I spent time in Riyadh, and I was brought back to Jeddah. So my interaction with hundreds of prisoners in different prisons, the wise estimate is that they have about 15,000 to 30,000 political prisoners only. You know, people like me, who are just there as a prisoner of conscience, or who are just there because they spoke something, or said something, or wrote something. I mean, there's no exact figures. All these would never tell you. Like, as I said, from the wild estimate can be anything between 15 and 30,000.
And this is a country that sits on the Human Rights Council and basically tells the UN who they can put on their blacklist. It's unbelievable.
Yeah, that's the same country we're talking about. You're right. I mean, there is absolutely no judicial system there, especially for the political prisoners. There are no trials. Even monkey courts will probably have better trials than what have there. And there, you don't see any lawyer, you don't see any documents, you're never told what's the allegation on you. And only one day you simply realize that you're simply not even told that you're being taken out for execution. It's actually like that, you know. They would never tell me when they would shift me to the next prison, and they would never tell me what is the charges and allegations on me, when would I see my lawyer or family or from people from the embassy. And it was exactly, for everyone else, it was exactly the same. There are no rules, there are no criminal procedure code, there are no clauses against which are shown to you, this is the allegation on you, you have broken these laws. If we don't like you, so you're going to stay in or we'll chop your head off, that's it.
And of course, that's because the whole country is considered the private property of the Ibn Saud ruling family, so they can do anything they want. There doesn't have to be any rule of law.
I mean, that's how it is. In fact, there is absolutely no rule of law. When I would talk to them and I would say, why have you arrested me? I have not broken any law here. I have not said anything against you. I have only stopped my army from going into Yemen because it was in the larger interest of the Muslim world. And they would say, no, that has hurt our interests. And for that, we think you work, we affirm, we are sure that you work for Iranian intelligence agencies. And for that, you're going to chop your head off. No evidence, absolutely. Absolutely rubbish allegation. Complete farcical, absolute baloney. But still, I mean, that's what the charge is on me. It's a miracle. It's a judicial miracle. It's a political miracle that I actually came out alive in 4 months, unscratched. And because, alhamdulillah, we had powerful friends in Pakistan who actually crashed upon the Saudis, told them what they are doing is a massive blunder, and the Pakistani nation would go against them. And the patriots in Pakistan would actually become hostile to Saudi Arabia. And lots of other things also happened in Saudi Arabia at that time, that like the accident in Mina where 7,000 pilgrims were actually killed, or I would say butchered, in a stampede, which
yeah,
was orchestrated
yeah. It appears that was caused by a prince. Wasn't that supposedly there was a retinue of a prince that caused that stampede, and there are some people who think they did that intentionally in order to grab some high-level Iranians.
So that's what I'm. So because of those events, the pressure that came upon the Saudis globally was so intense that it helped me. It helped the pressure that our friends were building on the Saudis. The Saudis thought, get him out of the way so we can deal with the pilgrimage issue, you know. And by miracle, by absolute luck, by grace of God, by mercy of Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala, I actually was pulled out of the Saudi jail. Because out of their own frustration, they couldn't find anything, and our friends in Pakistan were putting pressure on them to get me released, and the media and the patriots in Pakistan were waging a campaign to get me secure me. So I came out. But what I saw inside is so horrendous, actually. It raises hair on your back. I mean, the 15-year-old kid, 85-year-old man, people whose families don't even know they're alive. They think they're dead, disappeared in the desert. But they're alive, they're inside. Thousands of them.
So they just disappear people. And these are supposed, a lot of these people are, you know, just suspected of saying the wrong thing about the ruling family or hanging out with the wrong people, these kinds of things. I mean, it's not like these people are organizing armed revolution against Saudi Arabia. Not that that would be a bad thing. But no, these are just basically peaceful people who've gotten caught up because of, in some cases, they're what they say. In other cases, just who they're associated with. And maybe some of them are just kind of mistakes. It's crazy.
You see, I'm not saying there are no terrorists inside those political prisoners, political jails. I mean, there are maybe to 10%. People who try to bomb or suicide bombers or people who try to kill Saudis. I mean, Saudis have a right, of course. If they find somebody with a suicide jacket, they have the right to put him in prison. Fine. But the 90% of the people in those jails are those who are prisoners of conscience, as we declare them. Like people like me, who had not committed any crime, who were not violent, who were not militant, who were not aggressive, who just gave an opinion, or maybe wrote some article in the newspaper or on a Facebook or on a Twitter account, from all over the world. I mean, there were an Egyptian journalist, I don't know his name, I was told about him, that he wrote something 6 years ago in an Egyptian newspaper against the Saudis, and the Saudis waited for him. So when he came for Umrah and Hajj, they caught him from the airport. You know, so they wait in ambush kind of thing. That's exactly what they did with me. But another interesting dimension is that while I was in prison, the Indians actually came to the Saudis and demanded my extradition. I mean, that's the amazing part. That's
wow.
The fascinating part.
The Indians? Oh, they probably dislike you.
The Indians reached Saudi Arabia.
And let's tell the listeners a little bit of the background there. You've kind of been a thorn in the side of the Indians because, you know, the background here is the Indian military and intelligence service is, of course, notoriously brutal and corrupt. What they're doing in Kashmir is every bit as ugly as what the Zionists are doing in occupied Palestine, and there's a current in India that thinks that Pakistan should still be part of India, and they want to take it back. And you're a Pakistani patriot who's working against that, and one of the more outspoken and successful ones. So you're probably not, and you're always exposing the shenanigans of the Indians and their false flag terrorism and their fourth generation warfare. They probably don't like you very much.
Well, that's an understatement. I'm the most wanted, hated man for the Indians in Pakistan, to put it very simply. And they want me dead. I mean, I'm their number one enemy. They show my face on the Indian media all the time and say, this is the man who's hitting us and hurting us. We want him gone. And so I expose their game plans, as you said. I expose their war against Pakistan. I develop their response, information war, counter-propaganda. I expose their disinformation. And I revived the nationalist patriotic sentiments within the nation against the Indian hegemony in the region. So naturally, I am their number one enemy in Pakistan. And the one who is waging the war of the narrative, war of the words, war of the media, information warfare. So when news came out that I've been arrested, Indians reached Saudi Arabia and they demanded my extradition. And obviously, when Indians would demand extradition of a Pakistani citizen, that would make Saudis very confused, because Saudis thought, I'm an Iranian agent. And why would Indians want an Iranian agent who's a Pakistani national? So it's getting confused now. You know, it's getting very murky. So, then obviously, and as I said, these things also generated extreme responses from Pakistan, because once India gets involved into anything, the Pakistani defense establishment and Pakistani patriots and armed forces, they get very alarmed. And naturally, it was the relationship between Pakistani armed forces and relationship between the Saudis and the rest of the Muslim countries are very close, even though political relationship may not be, but the defense relationship and cooperation is strong. So I assume, I'm not told who were the players actually involved in my securing my release, but I assume that they were very strong players within the Pakistani defense establishment who, once the Indians got involved, Pakistan armed forces got very alarmed.
That's right. The Saudis want a good way to have the Pakistani government say, release this guy, it's to, you know, start talking to the Indians about handing you over.
You see, interesting thing is that in Pakistan, the political government actually told the Saudis to keep me in jail, because I was a thorn on the side of the political government as well.
Well, that's true, yeah.
You know? So here is my own government telling the Saudis, keep him in jail, don't let him come out. If Indians come and they say, hand us over this man because we want him, because he's our enemy number one. And under this scenario, you can imagine coming out from Saudi Arabian jail in 4 months is, as I said, nothing less than a political miracle. And I came out without any conditions, without signing any papers, without any terms and conditions. So I came back, started speaking exactly the same way as I used to speak before, as I'm talking to you now. And I'm sure now I won't go back to Saudi Arabia. At least I can't.
Yeah, well, I'm a little concerned too, because I go on Press TV, which is based in Iran, and regularly say some very harsh but unfortunately accurate things about the ruling family of Saudi Arabia, that they're incredibly corrupt, they're a disgrace to Islam, they're bulldozing and destroying the Islamic holy places and monuments, they're propping up the Rothschild petrodollar on behalf of the Zionists and imperialists, they're working openly with the Israelis now to commit genocide in Palestine, and this ruling family is a bunch of sybarites. They're notorious for flying around the world and doing incredibly disgusting and decadent things that I won't even try to describe because it's Ramadan and I'm fasting, but I do describe them sometimes on Press TV. And somehow I think that I would not be very appreciated any more than you were if I went to Saudi Arabia. So basically we need to liberate the holy places before I can do pilgrimage.
I won't recommend you to go there.
No, no way. I mean, at this point, it's you know, telling the truth these days is getting, you know, the world is, seems that that opening that we had for a while in the world, where at least the Western countries sort of pretended to respect free speech and so on, it's closing down. It's getting harder and harder to tell the truth.
It was in every time like this, Kevin. In human history, the person who speaks the truth, stand up to tyrants, try to revive his nation, try to speak against the tyranny of the time, would always lose their heads or end up in jail. So all the free men of the world have spent time in jail. I mean, this has been happening throughout the human history. But of course, in these times, when the information can be transmitted so fast, so rapidly all across the world, it's an information burst which humanity is facing right now. This kind of thing has never happened before in the last 5,000 years of human history, of civilization that we document. But this is a very difficult age to live in. You speak something in one corner of the world, and within seconds, it's global. And you have all the enemies from all across the world pouncing upon you.
Right.
So it's a very risky world to live in these days, no doubt about it. And
everybody,
people who are speaking the truth in these times are the real heroes. There is absolutely no doubt about it.
Well,
alhamdulillah, I can count you amongst those. You're doing a very difficult job in very difficult environment. And my respects, all my respects to people like you, mashallah.
Well, thank you. I appreciate that. And you too, you know, I see you as part of this tradition of speaking truth to power that has existed throughout the world in all places and all times. And in the Islamic world, there in Morocco, the Malamatia tradition, which, you know, I know in other parts of the Islamic world, the Malamatia are, you know, these crazy people who do ridiculous things to show that they don't care what anyone thinks of them except God. But the Malamatia people in Morocco used to go before the ruler, the Sultan, and tell him exactly what they thought of him with absolutely no fear. And as often as not, the rulers were afraid of these truth speakers because they had barakah, they had a blessing from God for being such courageous truth speakers. And the rulers were afraid that God would strike them down if they did anything bad to the truth speakers. So there is that tradition in parts of the Islamic world.
Truth has its own intrinsic power. There's no doubt about it. It has spirituality in it. It has strange force field around it. Anybody who speaks the truth, even though he's unarmed, he's just a media person, a writer, or an analyst, or a journalist, but if he's generally truthful man, world is afraid of him. You're right.
Absolutely. Well, let's talk a little more about this Saudis and their controversies right now breaking out here in the United States. I think the establishment here recognizes that even by their corrupt standards, the Saudis are out of control. We hear from behind the scenes that supposedly the Saudis told the Obama administration before they attacked Yemen that this would all be over within a week or two, and that it was on that basis that the Obama administration went along with it and agreed to back it. I don't know if that's true or not, but that's the kind of the rumor. And there's some obvious tensions in that U.S.-Saudi relationship right now. We have the 28 pages scandal and the JASTA bill in Congress that would allow victims of 9/11 and other terrorist attacks to sue state sponsors of terrorism abroad. And it's written to target Saudi Arabia for 9/11. And if the 28 pages are released, which they may be, that will add to the ammunition of those pinning 9/11 on the Saudis, which, of course, is only a small part of the story. In any case, there is this huge scandal breaking out. And then now the Saudis have gone and bribed the United Nations to be taken off of the list of countries that abuse children. So all of these scandals are breaking out around the Saudis. They're bogged down in Yemen. They're bogged down in Syria. Nothing is going their way. The low oil prices that they've been ordered by their masters to create have bounced back at them and destroyed their economy. How long do you think that this corrupt regime in Riyadh is going to last?
Kevin, you have hit the nail on the head. Very few people are actually realizing within the Muslim world that the days of the Saudi regime are now actually numbered. I mean, all these factors that you have mentioned are basically the crash of their economy. They're just last year, they were almost $100 billion deficit of their budget. They are burning into their reserves, which IMF estimates if no other factor influences the Saudi economy, just the burning of their reserves would mean the Saudis would be bankrupt in 3 years. And the 9/11 bill that you said, which is, and then the Saudi threat to sell all the Saudi assets that they have in the United States, which would throw the U.S. economy into turmoil, and the White House had to threaten them, this would have backlash and consequences. So Saudis basically backed off, despite the fact that Senate passed the bill, 9/11 bill. So, and then their war, the bomb down wars in Yemen and Syria, the desperate Saudi attempt to create a 34 Sunni country military coalition, which would be led by Pakistan. Basically, they had the intention of using them in Syria and Yemen. Pakistan refused to fight in Syria and Yemen, though in principle agrees to defend the kingdom in case kingdom is attacked from any external power, which no external power is going to attack kingdom anyway. So, and the presence of the 15,000 people that I told you, or 30,000 people in the Saudi prisons, as I said, even if 10% were religious radicals, there was a very strong support to Daesh and ISIS in the Saudi prisons now. Because of the brutality, because of the crimes that the state is committing against its own people, more and more people are turning radical. Because the ideology of the Daesh and ideology of the Saudi state is actually the same. The difference is political. The Saudis want to hold on to the monarchy, and the Daesh wants to bring in an alternate model.
Yeah, man, so that's a breaking point. Yeah, because Daesh is, you know, they could be even worse than the Saudi royals, if that's possible.
That's what I'm saying. So, but Daesh has the most fertile ground in Saudi Arabia, because almost in half the population of Saudi Arabia is youth. And they are jobless, they're uneducated, they're uncouth, they're ill-trained. I mean, they're so dependent on expats to work for them that in Saudi Arabia you don't find a single Saudi carpenter, plumber, mason or electrician, because everybody from outside the world comes and works for them. They don't work. They're non-technical people. So, with this level of population that you have, and the disparity of wealth is so immense that the 99% of the wealth is owned by one ruling family and 1% wealth is distributed within the people, then the Daesh is a very fertile ground. And then add on top of it the war with Syria, with Iran. I mean, the Shias in Saudi Arabia are angry, fuming in rage. And this war in Yemen has actually turned the stable against the Saudis. There are border towns in Saudi Arabia, in the Najran and Jizan regions, which are actually not in control of the Saudi government anymore because of the missiles and the rockets that are coming in from Yemen into Saudi Arabia. And the YouTube videos are filled with those, that Saudi armored columns have been ambushed and destroyed in the gorges of Yemen on the borders between Saudi Arabia and Yemen. So it's a chaos, it's a crisis, and they've generated a fund, a theoretical, hypothetical fund to generate $2 million for alternate economic sources other than oil. But that plan will take 15 years to implement. And Saudis don't even have a year. Next year budget they don't have to spend. They're burning out into reserves, as you said. Next 2-3 years, if the same oil prices remain, Saudis will be bankrupt. They're taking loans right now. All the construction, major construction in Saudi Arabia has come to a stop because the government can't pay them. And Bin Laden company just fired 50,000 workers in a day. You know, because Bin Laden is the biggest construction conglomerate there. So,
and of course, they had a tragedy at the Hajj. Their crane smashed into the Grand Mosque and killed a lot of people recently.
Exactly, but that's not the reason why they fired 50,000 people. They fired 50,000 people because their government contracts are stalled. The government is not paying them because the government has no money. Even for day-to-day business, now the Saudi government has to take loans. So with this scenario, an upheaval in kingdom is a very real possibility within the next 12 months. And that's not too far. 12 months is like tomorrow in a geopolitical sense. And because the upheaval, if that takes place in that kingdom, would also upset the entire GCC, Gulf region, Dubai, UAE, Qatar, Bahrain, Oman, I mean, all these would tumble like dominoes because they're all dependent economies on Saudi's economy. So, and presence of the Saudis falling out with the Americans, Saudis falling out with the Russians, Saudis falling out with the Iranians, then an economic chaos, then the uprising within, and the power struggle within the royals, and the war in Syria and Yemen. I mean, this is mouthful for any, even for the most powerful country in the world, and let alone Saudis, who are absolutely not prepared to handle this.
Well, it's their mismanagement of practically everything, their relationships with important countries, their economy, it's mind-boggling. And, you know, starting these wars, attacking Yemen and Syria at the time, you know, exactly the wrong time. And then, why do you think that they pumped so much oil? I mean, the standard wisdom is the reason that the oil prices are so low is that the Saudis themselves pumped, started pumping more oil and refused to the OPEC proposals for limiting oil production. Now, why would they do that? The established wisdom is they're basically ordered to do it by their Zio-American masters who run the world's oil prices in order to wage economic warfare against Russia and Iran and Venezuela. But it's certainly not in their interest to have such low oil prices, is it?
I totally agree with you, because common sense demands they should have stopped their oil supply so the prices could increase, so the revenues could be generated. But whatever they are doing is against common sense. And actually makes you think, why on earth are they doing this? It doesn't make any sense. Nothing makes sense there.
Well, here, now let me throw out a possibility here. I just happened to catch this on public radio here in the United States, which is usually a vast wasteland of totally useless information, but there was a guest expert on who said that the Saudis are pumping like there's no tomorrow because there isn't any tomorrow. That is, they know that the last of the fossil fuel that's going to ever be pumped out of the earth is going to be pumped out in the next very short time frame. In other words, very, very soon, for some reason, there's no longer going to be widespread pumping of oil anywhere on earth. And so he said that the Saudis are intending to make sure that as much of the oil that is pumped between now and the end of the oil pumping era, which is going to be very soon, is pumped out of Saudi Arabia, rather than, you know, the tar sands of Canada and so on. And the host asked, well, what is this black swan, that's the term he used, that's coming, that's going to end the pumping of oil? And the guest was kind of coy about that. He wasn't very specific. It sounded like it could be a new alternative energy technology at best, or it could be World War III at worst. I mean, I don't know. But that was a very interesting little bit of information that I think sort of slipped through the cracks here in the establishment media. And I wonder if that's true. Have you heard anything that could possibly verify or disconfirm that?
Kevin, I would respectfully tend to disagree, because lots of theories have been thrown that why Saudis are doing this. One of them was that they are trying to destroy the fracking industry in U.S., so that that industry is destroyed, Saudis could take the economic losses for the time being, but the fracking would be destroyed and U.S. oil would not be produced, shale oil would not be produced. So, but I don't believe that. My assessment is, if you look at the holistic picture, that's not one single mistake, the oil pumping that the Saudis are doing. It's a systematic sequence of snafus, as they use the military term, mm-hmm. in a situation normal, all left up, you know. And they're systematically making a series of blunders, like their adventure into Syria, their adventure into Yemen, their very harsh treatment with their own population, their falling out with the Americans, their falling out with the Russians. They are being led into a trap by some very dubious advisors or from within them. And if you see the New York Times and you see the Independent and you see the Hollywood even taking, churning out movies, you can very clearly see the Zionists and the Americans are basically done with the Saudis. And now there's a plan for a regime change, not just for a political change, but also for redrawing of the map. You remember the map of the Colonel Rolf Peters that came out in 2001, where
yes.
they're talking about the blood borders, and they talk about the redrawing the maps of the Middle East. It was in 2001 when the Americans had not even invaded Afghanistan. Those maps had come out, and today, after 16 years, the entire Middle East is actually being redrawn on those exact lines. And in those maps, even Saudi Arabia was shown to be dismembered. I mean, there was no Saudi Arabia, there was no Najd, there was no Riyadh, there was no Saudi kingdom or government. There was only a Vatican, a holy sacred region of Hijaz, Makkah, Medina, and Jeddah. And rest of the desert was completely nothing. And then the oil fields and the oil region was under a Shia state from Iraq, you know.
Mm-hmm.
So whatever is happening, I personally feel that if the Condoleezza Rice called it the birth pangs of a new Middle East. And so it has to be Saudis now. When the Iraq and Syria and Libya and Yemen has been decimated, it had to be Saudis. It's their turn. So it's not just a matter of pumping oil. It's being part of being caught up in a greater game where reshaping of the Middle East is being done. Americans are now more aligned with the Iranians, and Saudis are done with. They are disposable now, and they will be disposed.
Sounds like it could be that they're being set up for a big fall, in which case though they could lash out in really nasty ways in the meantime. It's kind of surprising that Peters and his blood map would want to have the oil fields part of the Shia world allied to Iran and Shia dominated Iraq, because Iran has been a thorn in the side of the empire ever since the Islamic Revolution of 1979. And we're hearing a lot of anti-Iran rhetoric still, too. And the two major presidential candidates here in the U.S., Clinton and Trump, are both very, very anti-Iran, at least on the surface. How do you think the geopolitical managers would want to allow the Saudi ruling family to cede its role as the custodian of the world's biggest oil fields and hand that over to the allies of the Iranians, who are essentially an independent power that has been none too friendly to the West and to Zionism?
Kevin, there is one complex issue within the Muslim world that the rest of the world do not understand, vis-a-vis the relationship with the Americans and the Judeo-Christian civilization. The fact is that for the Americans, for the Israelis, it's the Sunni Islam which is the threat, not the Shia Islam. I mean, I'm making the statement, let me explain that to you. It seems very strange. It's an odd statement to make. But in the Sunni Islam, there is a concept of Khilafah, the central unified Sunni Muslim government across the world. Shias don't have any concept like that. They have a concept of imamah.
I argue with Shia friends about this. I tell my Shia friends they should get in on the Khilafah thing. Yeah.
You know, so the Shia concept is imamah. You know, they have single leadership of an imam, who is basically the imam of the Shias, because Sunnis don't accept Shia imams. So in 1924, when the Middle East was actually balkanized, when Saudi Arabia was created, when it was actually the dismemberment of the Ottoman Empire, which was also the seat of the Islamic Khilafah. You got it now? You know?
Yes,
and
yes.
It is the concept of Khilafah which scares the Americans a lot. Bush has actually said in his speech that they will never allow an Islamic Khilafah to be developed in the Middle East.
And of course, that's why they created this bogus Khilafah of Daesh.
Exactly,
To smear the
that's
idea.
That's precisely the reason.
So now the
actual pristine.
Right. When people hear the phrase Islamic State or Caliphate, they think of Daesh.
Exactly. That's exactly what the Americans have done, because they are afraid that Khilafat could come in the Sunni Muslim world, because the Sunni concept, which has remained within the Sunni world for the last 1300 years, and it was only broken down after the First World War when the Ottoman Turks were destroyed, and the Saudi Arabia and the Middle East and the Iraq and all these countries that you see today, they never existed before the First World War, because they were part of the Khilafat of Ottoman Empire, you know. And That is why the Americans created this fake Daesh, the Khilafah. So the world would take, this is how the Muslim Khilafah is going to be, which is again a hijacking, a psyops, an information war, a perception management, a narrative which the Zionist Christian civilization wanted to throw at the world, saying this is how the Khilafah is going to be. So, so basically, if you see, the Americans are afraid of this concept of Khilafah, revival of Khilafah, which is a very mainstream concept in the Sunni Islamic thought process. And but even though they take Islam as a whole as a threat, but within this whole, the Sunnis are a bigger threat, because Shias are 12% minority, only 12% within the Muslim world. That even if they are volatile and active and hostile, even if they are angry against the Americans, Americans feel, Jews feel, Zionists feel, they can handle the Shias later on once they deal with the main body of Sunni Islam, which is the actual threat. You got it now?
That makes perfect sense. And of course, I would argue that that's why we need unity, that essentially we shouldn't be thinking of Sunni versus Shia. We should be thinking of the five major law schools, including the Jaffery Law School, the main 12 or Shia law school, are all part of normative Islam. And that's the only way to beat this divide and conquer strategy.
That's exactly the argument that I have always built. And that's what landed me in the Saudi jail, because I said Pakistan should act as a pacifier. You know, Pakistan should not take sides in this sectarian war which the West is trying to build within the Muslim world. And that's why Pakistan has a very strategic role within the Muslim world, because Pakistan is close to the Arabs, Pakistan is close to the Turks, Pakistan is close to the Persians, Iranians, and even though the Persians are hostile to Arabs, and Arabs are hostile to Turks, and Turks are hostile to Persians, still they're all comfortable with Pakistan. And that's why you find all the enemies right now of the Muslim world, they are ganging up on Pakistan today. They have decimated the Middle East. The only large country left in the Middle East is Saudi Arabia, which is going to go down now. All the signs are that they would. The stranglehold is now coming tight around their necks. But Pakistan is still standing. And the war that they're waging in Syria and Iraq, they are waging this war since 9/11 against Pakistan. The Americans went into Afghanistan not for Osama bin Laden or Taliban. They went in there to destabilize Pakistan. And since then, we have given 100,000 lives. Pakistan is fighting a high-intensity, urban, asymmetric, decentralized war against its Afghan borders, not against the Indian borders. And every JSOC, Joint Special Operations Command, CIA drone wars, terrorist groups, insurgent groups, again, here also, the Americans hijacked the name of Afghan Taliban and created a local Taliban group called Tehrik-e-Taliban Pakistan, giving them the same name as Afghan Taliban. Then in reality, Afghan Taliban are local freedom fighters who are fighting against American occupation, while TTP are another Daesh, another ISIS, created by the Americans in this region to fight against Pakistan. So, as the ground war takes place, the war, the perception is even more ruthless, confusing the world. Nobody seems to make sense of what's actually happening. And even the policymakers get confused.
Right.
And that's where the role of people like you comes in, where you remove the fog and bring up the clarity, mashallah.
Yes, and especially people like you, because you've been a leading voice of truth and clarity in these matters in Pakistan. It sounds like the Pakistani political and military establishment may be starting to catch up with you. You know, listeners may not understand that the Pakistani ruling elite tends to be very secularist, very corrupt, and pretty confused, like you know, many so-called third world elites, and voices of truth and patriotism are not necessarily the ones that carry the day in a place like Pakistan all the time. But and I know you've had sort of an uphill struggle to alert your compatriots in Pakistan of the threat of what's really going on here with the post 9/11 asymmetrical war on Pakistan that you just described. But you recently sent out a notification that it seems the Pakistani military is starting to wake up. Maybe you could discuss that.
Yes, I mean, let me explain to our listeners that in Pakistan there are always two power centers. One is the political power center, the other is the military power center. And traditionally, historically, military has been the custodian of the country's ideology and the frontiers, and they are the guardians of the country. And the political, they are actually like politicians of area in the country, the bloody rascals actually. And they are for sale. You could put the high, they would sell their soul to the highest bidder. And this democracy that we have in Pakistan today was actually brought into place in 2007 by the CIA. It's a CIA-sponsored democracy. And as I say, the old idiom, be nice to America, they'll bring democracy to you. Now, that's exactly what they did. They brought democracy to Pakistan. And one of the most corrupt men in the world, Asif Ali Zardari, the man, when he shook hands with the British Prime Minister, the headline of the British papers was that the British Prime Minister should count his fingers. You know, the man was known to be a bloody thief. You know, and he was appointed as the President of Pakistan. And it was during this time that the America started this massive implosion of the Pakistani state, economic implosion, sending in insurgents, supporting terrorist assets within the political parties. Every political party of Pakistan has a militant gang. And it was absolute anarchy in the country. Even the general headquarters, the headquarters of the army was attacked, air bases were attacked, Pakistan army was taking massive casualties in an urban war where the enemy was not visible. Like the suicide bombings, like the IEDs, attacks in the urban centers, the Marriott Hotel in Islamabad was blown up, you must have heard that, the big news, you know?
Yes. Yeah.
So, everywhere in Pakistan, Islamabad looked like a city in a war zone, it looked like a garrison city because of the barricades and all and checkposts. So this kept on happening with Pakistan for the last 9 years especially. And that was a time when I came up in the media, started to explain the different dimensions of this war, the role of the CIA, the grand strategic objectives of the American presence in Afghanistan, their nexus with the Indians, their alliance with the militant terrorist proxy gangs, who are presented as Islamic militants, but actually they were CIA mercenaries, the role of the Blackwaters and the XE and the JSOC. So finally Pakistan Army started to understand what kind of war is being imposed upon us, because in fourth generation and fifth generation war was a new doctrine, and army was not actually, it came so fast, the Pakistan didn't know what hit us actually, you know, but it was, Pakistan army was able to regroup, reorganize, backed by our analysis, backed by our perception management, our information war, and now it has come to the stage that Pakistan has finally, I mean now, just last week actually it happened that Pakistan Army Chief stood up to the Americans and said, now we would not allow any violation of our sovereignty by the Americans. We will not accept the American hegemony in the region. Pakistan, in the meantime, in the last 4 or 5 years, aligned itself very strongly with China. And that China is the neighborhood gangster, as you'd like to say. And now they're aligned with Pakistan. China promised $46 billion of economic investment into Pakistan to reach the port of Gwadar, you know, and which the American state as a major threat. For the last so many years, Americans have been trying to dismember Pakistani Balochistan. They were trying to occupy Afghanistan and dismember Balochistan so that they could build their pipeline from Turkmenistan, Afghanistan, and Pakistan to Gwadar. They could control the Central Asian fuel assets, fuel pipeline. The war of the pipelinistan, you know, you must have heard that.
And so, a lot of people think that was one of the motivations for 9/11, was that there was that.
That's what I'm saying.
Yes.
So Americans were actually trying to control Central Asia, Afghanistan, and Pakistan for their pipeline. But Pakistan built a strong relationship with China as well, and China projected its force very powerfully, economic force. And now there's a plan called CPEC, China-Pakistan Economic Corridor. From China to Gwadar, there will be railway lines and road links, and China plans to take $1 trillion worth of its exports through Pakistan, and that's a huge stake. So, with this kind of strategic realignment, economic realignment, Pakistan has now stood up to the Americans and said, look, we will not allow your hegemony in the region, we will not allow Indian presence in Afghanistan, we would not allow India to wage war against Pakistan from the Afghan soil. Afghan intelligence, CIA drones, Indian raw, they are waging a war against Pakistan trying to stop the CPAC, and now Pakistan will not tolerate this. So in the last few weeks, there's a massive confrontation building between Pakistan and Americans now. And American delegation after delegation is coming, meeting the army chief. Pakistani prime minister is a moron. He's out of the country. The whole government is out of the country. He's the next extension of Zardari, one of the most corrupt men this country could produce. Again, brought through this fake fraud democracy. So there's a confrontation between the army and the political government also. Anything can snap at any moment. There could be a coup against the government. The government could face massive protests on the street against it, because there's some political parties which are creating chaos and crisis for the government because of the corruption. These Panama Papers which have come out have very hard hit the political government in Pakistan.
And do you think the Panama
all of them
papers
offshore companies?
Was the Panama Papers part of a fourth generation warfare operation designed to destabilize countries like Pakistan?
You see, Panama Papers, I personally believe that there was a deliberate CIA leak. There's no doubt about that.
Yes.
But there the target selection would be selective. They would first, they only take out those countries or governments or regimes where they want to create more anarchy, more chaos, more economic upheaval, part of the hybrid fourth, fifth generation wars. Because every multinational in the world has offshore accounts. And, but you are not seeing this kind of reaction happening in America or any other places. And also the fact is that the American economy is going down. Just like the Saudis are going down, Americans are also going down. And the U.S. government finds it an easy way to seize this so-called ill-gotten wealth so that it stabilizes itself economically, to pay off some debts, to be able to have some extra cash at hand, because the offshore economy is almost $20 trillion. And if out of that, in U.S. debt is $19 trillion. So imagine if you seize all these offshore accounts, declaring them as illegal, the debt is paid off. Well, if you could do that, I would do that.
It also forces the money launderers to put their money in the American onshore money laundering system.
That's what I'm saying. So this is a very easy way to grab money from those people you don't like. And that runs into trillions of dollars. So that makes them richer overnight. And lots of regimes would tumble, lots of economic upheaval would take place. So cascading effect in the poor country or in the countries where you want to create an upheaval. Well, every act has multiple objectives. But the Panama Papers have definitely hit Pakistan very hard because the whole political elite stands exposed. And there are people on the streets against them. It's one of the biggest crises in Pakistan right now. And because of that, the government is paralyzed. And the government is paralyzed. Army is panicking because India is moving around in the region. Indian Prime Minister was called the butcher of Gujarat, the manslaughterer, the person who burns humans alive and rapes the women and dances on them. Americans would not be giving visa to Modi just a few years ago because he was a genocidal monster. And now he's the best friend with Obama just because he has become the Prime Minister. So
that's
this
right.
Animal is actually going around in the region, isolating Pakistan, in Saudi Arabia, in Iran, in Afghanistan, in America, in Bangladesh, in Central Asia. And Modi is basically isolating Pakistan, sending in insurgents, sending in terrorist gangs, sending in money, waging an information war. And the environment is that once the Pakistan reaches an implosion level, so the Indian independent battle groups can roll into Pakistan under a military doctrine called the Indian Cold Start. It's a doctrine that they have developed that they would attack Pakistan without any warning. And to respond to that, Pakistan has developed tactical nuclear weapons because we don't have conventional army enough to stop the Indian independent battle groups rolling into Pakistan. So it has actually become that dangerous. Pakistan is the only country in the world which has developed tactical battlefield nukes because we don't have the conventional capacity to stop the superior numerical numbers of the Indian army which is waiting on our borders to roll in.
So
this is where the world has come in.
It's a very scary situation, and we only have about 30 seconds to a minute left. You mentioned the role of Iran in this, and that some of these fourth generation warfare terrorists that the Indians have infiltrated them into Pakistan and through Iran. Does that mean that the Iranians are letting that happen, or what's going on there?
You see, in the recent weeks, there is lots of tension has developed between Pakistan and Iran also because Indians are building the Iranian port of Chabahar. That is next to the Pakistani province of Baluchistan. So now what has happened is Pakistan has captured many serving Indian army and intelligence officers actually operating inside Pakistan, and they have come through Iran. Whether Iran knew about it or Iran did not know about it, that needs to be seen. But that has generated lots of friction between Pakistan and Iran. While Iran is having diplomatic and political economic relations with India, why is Iran allowing India to exploit Pakistan's vulnerabilities and waging a war against Pakistan? The Indians are trying to do that. So that's a very tricky situation for Pakistan now because Iran is a friend and a brother and ally. But its soil is being used by the Indians. And whether Iranis have been kidnapping or they were careless or casual or they didn't realize the intensity or seriousness of it, that needs to be seen, and that's what Pakistan is negotiating with them right now. But this is what Indians are doing. So with the Muslim world, like the Zionists in the Middle East, the Muslim world should be very careful of the Zionists in Delhi Modi is an animal. He's not a human being.
Well, that's right. And Indian intelligence notoriously has been cooperating very closely, if not having been totally taken over by the Israelis. Well, we've hit the end of the hour. Thank you so much, Zaid Hamid. I appreciate your incredible work. I appreciate your contribution to the book Another French False Flag, which is a brilliant geopolitical... Wait a second. Are you in that book, or are you in We Are Charlie, Not Charlie Hebdo? I'm getting spaced out about my two books. It's a fantastic contribution to whichever book you're in. People should buy both books, Another French False Flag, and We Are Not Charlie Hebdo. And your analysis, I think, is really unparalleled in terms of what's happening in that part of the world and the larger global situation as well. So keep up the great work, Brother Ramadan Kareem.
Stay blessed, Kevin, and to all the listeners, and Ramadan Kareem to all of you, and stay blessed, and inshallah, look forward to be with you again.
Inshallah.
May Allah be with you. Barakallah fi.
Barakallah fi.